we were completely slammed from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m., and voters have been steady since then.
Alaskans flock to the polls to cast their ballots. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 4th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Juneau School District settles the Bong Hits for Jesus case.
Everybody feels that it was in the best interest of the community to be done with this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com.
Like voters across the country, Alaskans appear to be turning out in big numbers today to cast their ballots. At a polling place in East Anchorage, voting during the lunch hour was relatively light, but precinct chair Lena Perry, who has been working the same election site for three decades, says overall she's never seen such a big turnout.
I've been working for elections for many, many years, and this is the most exciting one we've ever experienced. We had lines this morning at 7 o'clock extending outside the building, and we're just so happy that everybody is taking advantage of their privilege of voting.
Across Anchorage at a Midtown voting site, 22-year-old precinct chair Christine Ward was observing a similar trend.
It's been really strong. I've only been at this precinct for this past year, so the primary, of course, didn't have a very large turnout. But we've had, I think, well over 280 people so far. And, you know, it's only 1 o'clock.
At North Star Elementary School, Bruce Kelly says he has seen a lot of first-time voters. Kelly has been working the same site for the last 5 years and says he's used to having some downtime during the long election day, but that's not the case this year.
Turnout is very heavy today. I think we're looking at a record here, at least from this precinct. It's been going ever since we opened this morning. Steady.
In-homer polls also opened to a rush of people. Johnette Hedrick was a polling captain for Precinct 1 at Homer City Hall. Around lunchtime, she said it's the busiest election she's ever worked.
Polls opened at 7, and we were completely slammed from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m., and voters have been steady since then.
Hedrick says most people were cooperative and no one really lost their cool. She says election workers do their best to be accommodating and that a few tricks of the trade really help.
Having a good sense of humor and I guess saying their names right, correcting ourselves if we do say them wrong. And having a smiling as they enter.
Unalaska's polling place was busy today with a steady stream of voters. 4 hours before the polls closed, 620 voters and 100 absentee voters had already cast their ballots. Usually only 600 or so total turnout. Poll worker Linda Ellsworth says the voters are energetic.
Well, one thing we've noticed about the voters today is they're very excited about this presidential race. And there's a lot of new people that have never voted before. So that's very exciting.
Reports of heavier than normal voting also came in from Bethel, Juneau, Talkeetna, Dillingham, Haines, and Skagway. Polls across Alaska are open until 8 p.m. The Juneau Douglas High School student who took his free speech case to the U.S. Supreme Court has reached a final settlement with the Juneau School District in the so-called Bong Hits for Jesus case. The Juneau Board of Education accepted the agreement last night. Joseph Frederick will receive a total of $45,000 from the school district paid by its insurance company. David Crosby is the school board attorney.
There'll be no funds diverted from the educational program.
The high school has removed any mentions of punishment from Frederick's school records. The case started in 2002 during the Olympic torch relay when Frederick, then a senior, unfurled a hand-printed banner reading Bong Hits for Jesus. He was off campus at the school-sponsored event. The high school principal confiscated the banner and suspended him from school. The school district asked Frederick said Frederick was advocating drug use. He said he was asserting his right to free speech. He sued in U.S. District Court and lost, but won in the U.S. Court of Appeals. The school board appealed that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld the district's right to suspend Frederick and enforce its rules regarding drug messages. Earlier this year, the district attempted to sue for legal fees. Then the U.S. Appeals Court took up one remaining legal issue: whether the state constitution provides stronger speech protections than the U.S. Constitution. Crosby says it was time to put the case to rest.
This has been a highly contentious issue. It's diverted a lot of time and energy from the district, not to mention the amount of money it's cost to litigate it. And I think everybody feels that it was in the best interest of the community to be done with this. We were looking at the possibility of another 5 or 6 years to litigate to conclusion the Alaska constitutional issue.
The settlement requires Frederick to drop that question. Frederick's attorney Doug Mertz says it will be addressed in a spring forum at the high school. The two sides plan to bring in a constitutional law expert to discuss school free speech issues with students, faculty, and administrators. And Mertz expects the state constitutional question will come up in future cases.
If there are cases in the future where a student exercises his free speech rights and the district punishes him for it without an adequate justification, then it's always ripe for more litigation.
School board president Mark Choate says it's a relief to have the 6-year-old case settled. He says the agreement does not change the district's policies.
The district will continue to enforce its policies prohibiting students from displaying materials that district personnel reasonably view as advocating or celebrating illegal drug use, as permitted by the United States Supreme Court ruling.
The original Bong Hits banner is now in the Newseum in Washington, D.C., a museum dedicated to First Amendment freedoms. Joseph Frederick is studying in China. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, world walker Carl Busby puts his quest on hold.
You know, we've got everybody tightening the belts, and the Russians are being unfriendly. I mean, it's the worst combination of sort of circumstances you can imagine.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States. The Alaska Public Radio Network brings you the day's news each weekday evening on Alaska News Nightly, APRN, the voices of Alaska.
A smoky haze that's cloaked Fairbanks in recent days is being attributed to increased wood burning. Air quality dipped below Federal Environmental Protection Agency standards for the first time this season over the weekend. The air was classified as unhealthy for sensitive groups, but has improved with snowfall in the last day. Borough air quality specialist Jim Connor says colder than normal weather last month jump-started heating.
The temperatures dropped, so there's increased demand for space heating, and we're seeing is a result of increased, you know, wood and coal burning, and we can smell it in the air.
Heavy fine particulate output is the result of incomplete combustion, like what happens when wood or coal-burning appliances are damped down. There's been an increase in the number of wood and coal furnaces in the Fairbanks borough in the last year as high oil prices spurred a switch to alternative heating fuels. Connor says the furnaces have a high capacity to pollute.
We've seen a tremendous number of these outdoor wood boilers burning and really filling up any little topographical depression that they're in. It's really, those things are really beginning to show their ability to create particulates.
Connor says feedback from local heating appliance retailers indicates that as many as 2,000 wood and coal boilers were installed around the borough in the last year. That's expected to cause air quality to tank whenever cold, stagnant conditions settle over the area. Connor says cold air inversions have already begun to set up, trapping fine particulates close to the ground where they threaten people's health. The latest research links the tiny particulates, which can get trapped in the lungs, with disease. The city of Unalaska and the owners of the geothermal fluid near Makushin Volcano have different ideas on the best way to push the geothermal energy project forward. The city thinks the best next move is to drill more test wells in Makushin Valley. The resource owners want to pursue a feasibility study that uses lasers to determine the strength of the resource in different locations. KUCB's Ann Hillman has more on the diverging approaches.
Onalaska City Manager Chris Laddick is ready to drill. With $1.5 million from a state grant and $1.5 million from city funds, the city is prepared to drill another test hole near the base of the switchback road that runs through McCushion Valley. If they find hot enough fluids there, the geothermal project could cost millions of dollars less than one based further up the mountain where test holes revealed the resource in the 1980s. The current price tag for that project ranges between $150 and $300 million.
And we have a team of our experts that we've put together to look at this project, have been reviewing it for several years now, and they all agree the next thing to do is drill. We got the money. We're ready to drill. We just don't have an agreement in place.
The city and the owners of the resource, Kigusa Saluta Land Company, or KSLC, cannot come to an agreement on how much the city would pay for the heat produced by the resource.
Because we're not going to drill over there without an agreement from them. For obvious reasons, you don't have an agreement, you go drill, and you really find a great resource, the royalty cost just went up.
As KSLC continues to negotiate the royalties, the two sides disagree on how the royalty amount should be calculated. The company is also applying for a $3.2 million grant from the Alaska Energy Authority. KSLC representative and former Onalaska mayor Paul Fuse says the grant will fund feasibility studies that include laser resource evaluation instead of drilling.
What it is that we're proposing, there's a system called LIDAR, and it's a laser-based radar system that they've used in other geothermal locations to identify the most promising sites for drilling the wells. So that's going to be part of it. And if it shows that it's a good idea to drill at the base of the mountain in the valley, then that should proceed.
Even if the LIDAR test doesn't reveal more accessible fluids, Fuse says KSLC still wants to pursue the project.
I mean, it's going to turn out one way or another. You're either going to bring the fluid down from the top of the mountain, or you're going to be able to find it in the valley. And, you know, you just identify those options and say, what will each one of those cost? Because either one is a possible outcome.
The further away the fluids lie, the larger the development of the infrastructure must be. The city says it will require roads and bridges. KSLC says they could pump the fluid down from the top in pipes. Either way, it could hurt the economic feasibility of the project, unless, as KSLC proposes, the project is much larger. Fuse says they want to make a 40-megawatt plant that would provide the 10 megawatts needed to run the city and 30 extra megawatts more for making transportable fuels like hydrogen or ammonia.
When you do that, you get greater economies of scale. If you were able to produce those fuels, you could even much further reduce the cost of electricity to the community.
In the grant application, KSLC says that if they make transportable fuels, the project will pay for itself in displaced diesel fuel costs in less than 3 years. The grant does not mention that three-quarters of the theoretical displaced fuel is not currently being used. Laddick says the idea of expanding the project beyond just powering the city does not make the project more feasible.
Again, you can't finance it based on what could happen and what might happen in the future with hydrogen and some of these other alternative fuels.
What both sides do agree on is that even if the geothermal project gets up and running, the city still needs to maintain the diesel generators as backup. They also agree that without the processors buying into the project, it won't work. Few says they need the grant from the AEA to do feasibility studies to take to the processors so they will buy in. But the city doesn't want to be part of the grant. Laddick sees too many problems with it and feels the city wasn't involved in developing it. So the McCushion Geothermal Project remains at a standstill, and the community's energy issues continue on. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
European researchers have reported that satellite observations of Arctic sea ice show sea ice decline of 19% compared to the past five winters. Dr. Catherine Giles with the Center for Polar Observations and Modeling at University College in London says their research looks at the past six winters' data from a single satellite. Giles says thinner sea ice last winter verified extreme thawing during the previous summer.
So that's what has changed the area in the Arctic rather than it being redistributed. Ice thickness and ice extent or ice area can change in two ways, either by thermodynamics, so by the ice melting, or by dynamics, so it being blown around and blown into different areas and piling up. So it's important to know how the thickness is changing, because that tells us how the ice is actually changing as well.
Giles says 6 years' worth of data is not enough to confirm trends in Arctic ice conditions for the long term, but she does say that the information is useful for climate modelers to more confidently predict what will happen in the future. She says in November of next year, the European Space Agency will be launching a new CryoSat satellite.
And that will help us continue this data series into the future. And CryoSat's being specifically designed to measure ice in both the Arctic and the Antarctic, and it will provide kind of much greater coverage of the Arctic Ocean almost up to the pole. So we'll be filling in the hole in our data, and it has a much better resolution. It can see the ice in finer detail than the satellites we're using at the moment. So that new technology will be a great advancement for us.
Giles says researchers are now working on linking 15 years' worth of satellite data from two different satellites in order to help climate modeling programs look at longer-term predictions.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business, and by the University of Alaska, home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
One of Alaska's saddest distinctions is its continuing high level of domestic violence cases, one of the highest in the nation. But a new partnership against domestic violence in Anchorage is proving effective enough that the federal government wants to see it duplicated elsewhere in the state. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In 2005, four public and private organizations struggling against domestic violence created the Anchorage Domestic Violence Prevention Project. Judy Corbell, executive director of Abused Women Aid in Crisis, AWAKE, described Friday's press conference as a happy exception to normally doleful announcements on domestic violence.
This is good news. We're doing something effective. We enjoy a very strong and healthy partnership with the Anchorage Police Department, the Division of Health and Human Services, and the Prosecutor's Office.
The director of the Municipal Department of Health and Human Services, Diane Engel, relayed some specific accomplishments of the partnership.
The number of defendants charged with violating conditions of release has increased by 50%. The number of arrests for violations of conditions of release has increased by 20%. And the number of unlawful contacts where perpetrators violate conditions of release and contact the victim has decreased by 75%.
Anchorage Police Chief Rob Hune added more positive results dating from the beginning of APD's proactive approach.
Since the initiation of the project in October of 2006 through this August, there have been 930 compliance checks conducted. 132 individuals were rearrested for failing to comply with the conditions of bail. That's over 14% of the contacts that we made.
The big difference is that thanks to the partnership, APD officers now have access to the probationary requirements of the defendants. Joanne Chung, with the Municipal Prosecutor's Office, says three clerks are assigned to enter into a database all the probationary requirements as soon as a judge issues them.
When officers on patrol have then random contact either by a traffic incident or response to any kind of a disturbance with these defendants and or victims, there is a flag when they look up the person's criminal history.
The defendant doesn't even have to be with or threatening the victim. If the terms of the probation say no drinking alcohol and he stopped for a DUI, that's grounds to revoke his domestic violence probation and he goes to jail. Chung says the prosecutor's office also keeps victims appraised of all court and hearing schedules. Health and Human Services Director Engel says because of the partnership's success, the Federal Office on Violence Against Women has given the department $750,000 to expand the project statewide. William Stafford is one of two APD officers assigned to perform no-notice compliance checks. He says those checks are causing some accused aggressors to change old habits.
Once they bail out, they say, hey, we're here to check on you, make sure you're following their conditions of release. We find them there at the house with the victim, and we arrest them, and they are very surprised that we're out there checking now.
Perhaps even more important, the new project is changing victim behavior.
They're more willing to, number one, report the assault initially, and they're more willing to follow through with the prosecutors. In the past, they would sometimes recant because of fear of reprisals from the person who assaulted them.
Despite this progress, Anchorage domestic violence rates remain high. The partnership has recorded well over 3,200 domestic violence cases since October 2006. Over 2,100 involved children. Awake statistics show it sheltered nearly 1,500 victims in 2007, about half being children. This is Len Anderson.
The city of Petersburg has rejected an application to recall City Councilor Melinda Hofstede. The city's attorney Monday determined the application did not give adequate reasoning for a recall. However, recall supporters say they will rework the application and plan to submit it again. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
13 Petersburg residents sponsored the recall application and turned it into the city last Thursday. It sought a petition to recall Hofstede for misconduct in office and said her misconduct had wasted tens of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money. However, City Attorney Paul Dillon Monday wrote that the recall application contained no particular conduct, facts, or details supporting misconduct. Dillon cited a 1984 court case involving the Bering Strait School District. In that case, a court found that an office holder should be presented with some facts or supporting details in order to be able to respond to the allegations. Hofstede says she was not surprised the application was rejected.
Just not liking someone or disagreeing with their politics is not a reason under state law to be recalled. That's what happens in a regular election. When you don't like someone for any reason, whether it be their politics, their style, their personality, or whatever, in a regular election, you can vote or not vote for them. But once a person is elected to their term, the recall has to be because they're incompetent or because they've had misconduct and broken the law in office, or they've had dereliction of duty. And I'm not surprised that the attorney found that the petition was insufficient, because I haven't done any of those things. And I think the people behind the initial petition for a recall basically just don't agree with me.
Supporters of the recall are taking issue with Hofstede's conduct as a city councilor. In particular, they say a hostile work environment complaint that she brought against Mayor Al Dwyer this year ended up costing the city over $19,000 in attorney fees. Hofstede says she never wanted to involve an attorney with that complaint and says she does not want to revisit the issue.
It's painful in a small town. It's been hard on Al's family, hard on him, hard on me, hard on my family and friends. And I would never have raised this again. And I'm sorry that these people raised it with the petition, because I want this thing to be over. We're working a lot better together. I think the mayor has made every effort to try to follow Robert's rules since this complaint. He's doing very well, as far as I can see, to treat everybody respectfully. And things have been going so much better. And I'm sorry that this has had to be raised again, but it's a dead issue and I want to leave it dead.
However, recall supporters say they'll redo their application and resubmit it. Former Councillor John Haverlick says they'll go into more detail with their complaint.
The committee that originally came up with the petition feels this is still important enough. We don't want to have the city sued and keep making these expenditures that are unnecessary. So we are going to submit. We were just under the impression when we submitted the first petition that, you know, most lawyers say less is better. But this attorney with the city feels more explanation is better. So we'll just make it longer. Yeah, you know, that was the only problem with it. It just needed to be defined more.
Haverlick says he expects they'll turn in their new application relatively quickly. State law says grounds for recall are misconduct in office, incompetence, or failure to perform prescribed duties. The city has 10 days to review any new application and decide whether to issue a petition. If the next attempt is up to state standards, recall supporters will need to gather signatures of 181 local voters. That's one quarter of the people who voted in Petersburg's city council race last month. Enough petition signatures would force a special election on the recall sometime next year. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Wicknicki.
On the 10th anniversary of the start of his round-the-world walk, British adventurer Carl Bushby's expedition is on hold. Bushby's father and manager Keith in England says progress has ground to a halt. He says Carl is trying to find sponsors and negotiate a return to the remote Chukotka region of Russia, where he left off walking last spring. Bushby's dad says soured economic conditions and relations with Russia have complicated the situation.
You know, at a time when we need a sponsor and we need the Russians on our side, we've got exactly the opposite. You know, we've got everybody tightening the belts and the Russians are being unfriendly. I mean, it's the worst combination of sort of circumstances you can imagine.
Keith Bushby says Carl was in Portland, Oregon over the weekend to fulfill a speaking engagement for one of his few sponsors, a boot supplier. He says Carl can't afford a cell phone, let alone costly trips back to Russia, where new rules limit foreign travelers to 90-day visas. He says the restrictions don't give Carl enough time to travel in the remote region of Siberia he's trying to cross.
Sometimes it can take him a month from where he lands to get back to the point where he can start walking again, to the point where he left off last time. And of course, then he walks for a month, and then he's got to think about the last the 3 months to finding his way out again. So in theory, it could only be 2 months a year, and there is no way he can cover any sort of distance.
Keith Bushby says Carl needs to secure a visa waiver or alternative visa to continue his journey across Russia. Carl Bushby has covered about half the 36,000 miles of his planned walk home to England from where he started in 1998 at the southern tip of South America. He walked into Fairbanks back in 2004 and has since staged operations out of the community, where he has received strong support, including free air travel from Frontier Flying Service. But Bushby recently lost his main local supporter, Ramey Wood, who ran stateside logistics for Bushby, says he severed ties with the expedition this summer out of frustration.
There's a growth, a development, a maturing that the expedition needs as an organization. To sustain something this long, you have to be big enough and strong enough to do that. And the expedition has been a mom-and-pop operation, and there's a lot to respect it. Because of that, I have a lot of respect for Carl and Keith to have achieved what they've achieved on the shoestrings that they've done it. To get back to England, however, I think there's going to have to be a lot more support, organizational support, both from the expedition itself, but also organizational support from outside.
Wood says the expedition has become vastly more complicated since 2006, when Bushby made an unprecedented modern sea ice crossing of the Bering Strait. Keith Bushby says the expedition has surmounted many roadblocks in the last decade, and they're not giving up. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Casey Kelly in Homer, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Joe Wicknicki in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Support for APR and coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.